It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Last month, four volunteers entered a habitat on the planet Mars. Okay, actually, they entered a habitat on the planet Texas, but it simulates a Mars habitat. It's at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. NASA selected four volunteers who are expected to remain there for a little over a year. One of them is Dr. Nathan Jones. He's an emergency medicine specialist from Springfield in central Illinois, not an astronaut. But the mission of Dr. Jones and his colleagues is to help NASA determine how to make life on a future Mars mission sustainable. NASA is not making Jones available for interviews today, so instead we're going to be talking about the mission with Scott Smith, who's a co-investigator for the Crew Health and Performance Exploration Analog, or CHPEA. Scott, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So where did the idea for this mock Mars mission come from?
Well, this originated, I suppose, 5 or 6 years ago. And we had wanted to simulate a Mars mission. And one of the aspects of the space station is that there are a few things that are unique about food. That is, the crews eat a standard set of food, but they get to augment that with about 20% of their food items or things that they pick. And that's not going to be possible on an exploration class mission like a Mars mission. The other thing that's unique about space station is literally every time a cargo vehicle goes up or a crewed vehicle goes up, they will pack in some fresh fruits and vegetables. And it's not much, but psychologically, nutritionally, it provides some benefit. And again, we're not going to be able to do that on a real Mars mission. So the idea came about of, okay, how do we simulate this? And we were off to the races. An awful lot of meetings, a lot of planning, trying to figure out the best way to do this, where to do this, how to do this. And here we are 30 days in or 30 plus days in with the crew in the habitat. It's really exciting.
So it may seem obvious why, I guess, if you are on the space station, you get these regular resupply vehicles, either with additional crew members who are coming aboard or just cargo only. Just say a little bit more about why that's not practical for a mission to Mars, fresh fruit or vegetables, for example.
Well, indeed, a mission to Mars is going to take a lot longer than the few hours it takes to get to space station. So really, most of the food that we expect to send on the early Mars missions, if you will, is going to be prepackaged, and it's going to be one set of food, and then we're going to send the crew. So each crew member is not going to have the opportunity to pick foods that they want. They're going to be given foods that we think most people like, but they're going to have to deal with the fact that that there's not going to be much self-selection or any self-selection. And that balancing food reserves, balancing energy intake, maintaining body mass, maintaining your health, is all part of the constraints of keeping all the pieces together. And that's one of the key elements that we're testing in this CHPEA mission, is seeing how well the crew can do with their logistics and maintaining dietary intake.
So let's talk about the crew. How did you find these four volunteers? What makes them qualified for this mission?
Well, there was a nationwide search. There were a large number of applicants, and the screening process was not unlike what we do with astronauts. There were questionnaires and screenings. There were medical exams. There were interviews. And they whittled down to these four folks, which, as you said, they're not astronauts, but I would say that they are very astronaut-like. They work well together. They can work in hard environments. We did send them out for wilderness training in Colorado to see how they could work as a team. And that was how we came to these folks. And when you look at these individuals and you look at the task ahead of them, really, I don't think we could have picked four better people.
What other training? You mentioned wilderness training in Colorado. I presume they're not going through the full NASA astronaut training, which includes a lot of physics and piloting technology and other things like that. What sort of training did they have to get, though, for this?
They reported to Houston about a month before they actually went into the habitat. And they were trained on what they were going to need to do while they're in there. There were simulations of different parts of the study. Their schedules when they're in there are going to look just like astronaut schedules in flight, that there's going to be experiments they need to do. There's going to be exercise taking care of the habitat, taking care of facilities, doing Mars walks, if you will, out in the sandbox. They're going to be growing some pick and eat crops, and they're going to need to be able to do all that. So they're going to have timelines every day that tell them what they need to do. And again, we spent about a month training them on the habitat, on the systems, the machinery, and how everything was going to be laid out, so that they were ready literally on day one.
Let's talk a little bit about the habitat then. Paint a picture for us. What does it look like? What does it feel like being in there?
It's pretty impressive. It's a 1,700 square foot habitat. It has separate living areas and work areas. It's got four individual bedrooms that each crew member gets a private bedroom. There's a bathroom, there's a shower, there's a kitchen area, there's a lounging area where they can watch TV. They've got some video games in there. And then there's a work half of the building, which has some robotics area where they'll be doing some remote piloting of vehicles while they're inside the habitat. There's an exercise area, there's a medical area for blood collections and other biological sample collections. And then there's an airlock, which leads out to a 1,200 square foot red sand box that, again, they'll be doing spacewalks or Mars walks, if you will. And then out there, there's a treadmill that they will use to simulate traversing across the planet to go look for new rocks in different places. There's structures they're going to have to build out there, and things like that. So the schedule is going to be very busy. The schedule is going to be very challenging. 1,700 square feet for four people is not bad. It's long lines of, I suppose, a small, you could say, four bedroom apartment. But the bedrooms are a little bit like a small dorm room, if you will. So my impression when I first walked in is it's bigger than you'd expect. But at least in my head, I had no interest in staying in there for 378 days.
Yeah, for more than a year. That is quite something. So talk about some of the preparation it took to actually design the environment. You mentioned this giant red sandbox and the building itself. What materials go into creating this habitat?
Well, the building, the habitat itself is just incredible. And they 3D printed the building out of cement. It was tinged red to give it a Martian feel. And it, the way the 3D printing worked is it looked like when you're using an icing bag to squirt icing on a cake, except it was a lot bigger than that, and it squirted out a line of cement. And they went around the entire thing and then started on the next layer. So it looks, it has sort of a unique feel to it. So that's the building in and of itself. As I said, when we started talking about this 5 or 6 years ago, we had nothing but the idea. So we did look at what are the different possibilities? Where might we do this? How could we do this? When we came to the fact that building it on site was our best option, we looked at different ways to build it. And then a lot of people talked about the different engineering aspects of how the mechanics needed to work, or how the human factors needed to be set up. I talked about that there's more of a living area and then a work area. And that was one of the things that we'd heard from station crews, that it's important to be able to separate yourself from your work environment, just psychologically. And all those things went into, you know, where do we put the plant growth habitat? Where do we put the medical facilities, and how do we piece this together? And a lot of planning went into what it looks like. So really incredible stuff. And then once we had the concept, once we had the building built, once we started preparing for it, there were a series of reviews by management, from engineering, from safety, from the human subjects review people, to ask every single question of, well, what are you going to do if? Have you thought about that? And, you know, at NASA, we love our contingencies and planning for anything that could happen. There's a procedure written out for what do we do. Now that, you know, we always like to plan out for everything, and the things that happen tend to be the things we didn't think of, but the training that the ground support team has gone through in terms of planning this, I know that those folks are ready no matter what.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, if you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking with Scott Smith, who's a co-investigator for CHPEA, which is a NASA mission. It's called Crew Health and Performance Exploration Analog. It's a simulated Mars habitat at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. Among the volunteers on this mission is an emergency medicine physician from Springfield. So we've been talking about simulating this Martian environment. I'm guessing there are limits to that, right? Gravity on Mars is 38% of that on Earth, 100. So that's 100 pounds on Earth would only weigh 38 pounds on Mars. Is that something that you cannot, obviously you cannot simulate outside of the, what's that airplane called? The Vomit Comet that NASA has?
That's correct. Gravity and radiation is the other thing that we can't simulate. We're not simulating. But what one of the key elements of this is that there is a communication delay, so that, like on Mars, it will take 22 minutes for a message sent to Earth to get back to Earth. So if the crew has a question about where's the food for mission day 27, it takes 22 minutes for mission control to get that question. If they type the answer immediately and hit send, it takes 22 minutes to get back. So there's essentially a 45-minute communication delay for anything, and that again is one of the elements of isolation and confinement, the logistics constraints. They need to watch their food consumption rate. They need to watch their water consumption. They need to make sure they're getting all their other tasks done. These are all elements of spaceflight missions, and those are the things that we're simulating here. We use spaceflight, we use analogs in many ways. And what analogs do is they simulate different elements of spaceflight. So they're not spaceflight. But for instance, when we want to look at things like bone loss or muscle loss, we can put people in bed rest for a month or two and look at how their bones change. When we want to look at isolation and confinement issues, we go to Antarctica and look at the people that are wintering over there for 6 months, where essentially they can't get out. They're in a small confined area with a small group of people, and we've done a lot of work studying them. And this is another analog, and we've captured several elements that are difficult to simulate in other analogs, and are capitalizing on that.
Yeah, that's interesting, because one of the things I had wondered about is like communication with friends and family on an actual Mars mission. As you said, it's going to take, what, 22 minutes for any message to get back. I imagine it's mostly text messaging, not video chat or anything like that. Maybe you can, I don't know how, you know, what the data capabilities are of sending a video message over that distance, but is there communication with family, or is it subject to these same parameters you've been discussing?
It is subject to the same parameters. I believe, I don't know the exact details of it, but I'm pretty sure they can send videos back and forth. Obviously not too big, but it's a little bit like, you know, you sometimes see in the movies where you'll talk to the camera and record a video and hit send, and somebody will then get it. So it wouldn't classify as a chat, but it's more of a one-way movie.
Wow, that's fascinating. What about the astronauts on Mars? Will have to create their own atmosphere, obviously. I think the current NASA, at least on the International Space Station, the breathing mix is what, 21% oxygen, the rest nitrogen. Is air simulation part of this habitat, or are they breathing Earth atmosphere?
They're breathing Earth atmosphere.
Okay.
And on station, to make your point, indeed, station, the air is very similar to what it is on Earth. We're actually doing other studies looking at what we call an exploration atmosphere, where they use lower pressure with higher oxygen percentage to maintain oxygen consumption. But that with a lower pressure, it's sort of like an airplane where if you lower the pressure, it doesn't leak as much.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So you don't need to have the higher, I guess, strength walls of a ship. Maybe that lowers costs and factors like that.
Right. And again, just like airplanes, airplanes are typically pressurized to about 10,000 feet. Even though you're further above that, you're not pressurized all the way back to Earth.
Huh. Fascinating. All right, we need to take a break on the program. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Scott Smith, who is a co-investigator for the Crew Health and Performance Exploration Analog at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. This is a mission to help NASA determine how to make a future Mars mission more sustainable. We're talking about this because one of the volunteers, one of the four volunteers on that mission, who is going to be in this simulated Martian habitat for a little more than a year, is a doctor from Central Illinois named Dr. Nathan Jones from Springfield. We taped this conversation ahead of time in order to make our schedules meet, so we're not taking calls live during our program today, but we do love hearing what you thought about the show. So you can always send an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org, or you can leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. We're going to take a short break, then we will continue our conversation with Scott Smith. You're listening to The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking with Scott Smith, who's a co-investigator for the Crew Health and Performance Exploration Analog, or CHPEA is the acronym. This is a NASA mission based at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, to help NASA determine how to make life on a future Mars mission more sustainable. One of the volunteers on that mission is Dr. Nathan Jones, who's an emergency medicine specialist from Springfield. He could not join us because of, obviously, the simulated Martian conditions. Communication takes 22 minutes one way from Mars, and that is this one of the constraints that the people on this mission are experiencing. You know, I've got a million questions about daily life. So a day on Mars, I think, is known as a sol. It lasts 24 hours, 39 minutes, and some number of seconds here on Earth. Are the people in the habitat on Earth time or Martian time?
They're on Earth time, working a standard 24-hour day.
And are there, I wonder if someone begins to show strain from the pressure of this confinement, this environment. There's no, you know, fire exit or door or anything where they could just kind of let themselves out.
The habitat is not locked, so they can walk out anytime.
No.
But if they, once they walk out, they're out. That there's no, I just need a minute. And then I'll do the rest of the time.
Yeah.
So indeed they're not locked in, but, and we work very hard to select people that we thought could handle this.
Yeah.
And we're doing a lot of things, to help make sure that we keep them happy and healthy, and doing their work.
So you're a nutritionist, I understand, and a manager for nutritional biochemistry at Johnson Space Center. So let's talk a little bit more about what they're eating and what you're hoping to learn from that. We talked earlier about some of the constraints. You can't have a lot of fresh food. You said there's not a lot of choice. So what would food be like on a mission to Mars?
Well, the food system actually looks a lot like what the crews on space station are consuming. And what that means is that about half the food is freeze-dried and rehydratable, and the other half is what we call thermostabilized, which is essentially the same technology as canning, but it's in a foil pouch. And we use the same technology for, if you're familiar with the meals ready to eat or MREs that the military uses. It's the same packaging technology, but we have our own formulations, our own recipes. And then there's some natural form foods, but that is the bulk of it. The food system, I always tell people, it's better than you probably think, but it's not as good as it could be. You know, it's not restaurant quality. It's not what you can make at home with fresh foods you just bought at the grocery store. But it's not that bad.
It's come a long way from the Apollo missions and the, you know, toothpaste tubes of food that maybe used to be on the early NASA missions.
We've come an awful long way from there. We've come an awful long way from there.
What are some of the concerns about nutrition in space, right? Like, I think we had to figure out scurvy. It took our species a long time to figure that out in the days of sailing and nautical exploration. What are some of the lessons we've had to learn about nutrition in spaceflight?
Well, that's a great point, and thanks for making it, because when I go out and give presentations, the first slide I show is a slide of the replicas of Columbus's ships. And I make the point that when we talk about exploration and nutrition, that scurvy is a classic example, and that scurvy killed more sailors than all other causes of death combined during the age of sail. And that the difference between those missions and the ones we're trying to embark on is that we're not likely to find food. So we need to make sure we understand the nutritional requirements, we understand the food system, we understand, are the foods stable? Over the length of time that we need them to be stable. So what we expect right now on a Mars mission is that we will send the food to Mars before the crew leaves Earth, meaning the food has to have roughly a 5-year shelf life, because the last item that's going to be eaten will be that old by the time the crew gets there. So imagine trying to pack your pantry with foods that you're going to want to eat in 5 years, that are going to still taste good, that are going to have the nutrition in it that you need, and you start to see some of the challenges. One of the issues that will come up with Chepia is that the food system tends to be very repetitive. So about every 9 days, they get to open up a new set of containers, and that new set of containers is the same as the last set of containers. So even if you pick your 9 days of your favorite foods, if you do that enough, you get tired of it. Even if it's whatever, steak and lobster and whatever, the repetition will start to eat at you. And menu boredom is one of the things that we're hoping to overcome in this mission, and one of the things we'll be keeping an eye on from a food and nutrition point of view.
That's so interesting. You mentioned meals ready to eat, and I think in the military, they certainly learned that lesson. We saw when the U.S. Army and Marines went into, and Air Force went into Iraq and Afghanistan, there were Subway, you know, restaurants, McDonald's going up on their bases, at least the big, rearward bases. Obviously, that's not something you can do in space. What are some of the psychological challenges? You mentioned that repetition. Why is that? What's happening there?
Well, again, as I said, even if you picked your favorite meals and you ate them over and over, you get very tired of them. And one of the things we've learned, one of the things we hear from space station crew members all the time, is that the food in and of itself is pretty good, but that the biggest thing we need is more variety. So we always strive for the maximum variety. But, you know, food is one of those things, a lot of people don't think that much about it, but food psychologically is incredibly important. And when you're in a habitat simulating a Mars mission, when you're on a space station, food is one of the things that reminds you of home. It gives you comfort, it gives you psychological benefit, and it becomes really, really important. So, you know, I've heard a number of space station astronauts say that, you know, before flight, they weren't worried about food because they'll eat whatever. And when they came home, said that, wow, that was much more important than they ever thought it was going to be. So that, you know, as a nutritionist, that's one of the key things that I'm focusing in on. This is a multifaceted analog study. The behavior and performance people are going to look at things like interaction of the crew and how well they perform. The exercise teams are going to be watching how well their exercise performance is. The horticulture people are going to be watching how well they can grow those plants and eat those. The EVA people are going to be watching how well the spacewalks go. So everybody involved in this has a different knot hole they're looking out of to see how their particular system is responding. But again, the nature of this and what makes this thing incredible is that we're testing all these things at the same time and seeing how they interplay.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by this. As you mentioned, the multifaceted nature of this. I know it's not necessarily your area of expertise, but it does relate in terms of the agriculture. What sort of crops does NASA think we might be able to grow on Mars? And, you know, what are some of the limitations to that? Obviously, I don't think you're going to be able to have acres and acres of enclosed sort of greenhouses, or maybe that is the plan. I don't know.
Well, the early missions will likely look like what we're doing in Chepia, which is they have a small area set aside for hydroponics. The crew is actually given a long list of things that they could grow, and they select it down to a whole host of what we call pick and eat crops, things that you, as it sounds, you can pick it and just eat it. There's not a lot of processing. There's not a lot of work required. And they pick things like tomatoes and peppers and different types of lettuce. And I think it's fair to say on early Mars missions that it will probably follow the same suit. Someday we may have acres and acres of wheat fields on Mars, but that's going to be pretty long after the first time we get there.
I'm guessing in conversations like this, I'm not going to be the first person to ask you if you've seen the movie The Martian or read the book that it's based on. And I wonder if so, what you think of that and how well, or maybe where it has some misses on the science, particularly as it relates to your area of expertise. And maybe I should just recap for listeners. This is about an astronaut who is accidentally left behind. His crew thinks he's dead. Turns out he survived. He doesn't have nearly enough rations to get by. It was supposed to be a shorter mission, and he ultimately ends up figuring out how to grow his own potatoes on Mars. I wonder what you think of the science of that film.
Well, I'll say there was a great movie in and of itself. The trick with potatoes, and we looked this up at one point, I don't remember exactly, but I think there's 12 nutrients that you would be deficient in if you ate nothing but potatoes.
Yes, my Irish ancestors definitely can tell you that firsthand, I'm sure.
Exactly. And, you know, that's one of the things that we I suppose, take for granted here on Earth, and that there's an overabundance of types of food. We eat a very mixed set of foods, and that's how we avoid things like vitamin B12 deficiency, for example. So if anybody wants to go on the all-potato diet, I wouldn't recommend it. But again, it was a great movie. You just have to realize it's art more than science.
Yeah, absolutely. So, all right. So this is the first simulation, the first analog. It began in June. I understand there will be a couple more. What other things will these simulations be looking at? How many are you planning?
We're planning for 3 missions total. And really, we're hoping to do the exact same thing 3 times. Because what we're hoping to do is get enough data from different crew members and different crews to be able to compare. And looking at individual differences, looking at group differences, 4 people in one mission is not enough. So that's why we're hoping to do 3 missions. I believe the recruiting for the second mission will start sometime this fall. So if you're interested in being one of the next crew, you can apply for that.
It sounds like an incredible commitment. And I don't know if you can speak specifically to Dr. Nathan Jones, our Springfield emergency medicine physician, but how is the crew doing? How are they adapting to this isolation, to this environment?
I can't give individual specifics, but I'll tell you the crew's doing great. The crew's doing great. They're a month in now, a little over a month in. And again, from my knot hole, we had our first biological sample collections last week. So we collected blood and urine for our studies. We supported some saliva collections and fecal sample collections for the microbiome studies. And we'll do that every month. And as I understand it, the rest of the work is also going really well. The spacewalks are going off nominally. They've started growing their plants. And everybody's really happy.
Nominally, NASA speak for going well, right? Is the phrase there.
Exactly.
All right. All systems nominal. Well, this interview has been nominal. Scott Smith is a nutritionist and manager for nutritional biochemistry at the Johnson Space Center. He is a co-investigator on the Crew Health and Performance Exploration Analog. Scott, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today on the 21st show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that's all the time we have for our program today. Coming up tomorrow, Thursday, on the 21st show, we're planning to bring you a conversation with Lieutenant Governor of Illinois, Juliana Stratton. In order to accommodate her schedule, we need to tape that earlier in the morning than our live program. We'd love to include your questions. If you have a question for Lieutenant Governor Stratton, please send us an email. talk@21stshow.org is the address. talk@21stshow.org, or you can leave a voicemail, 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. Then tune in tomorrow on the 21st show for our conversation with Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. Before we go, I want to suggest you join our texting group. You can do that by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. We heard from a lot of you earlier this week about the student loan conversation and included a lot of your feedback in the show. We also recently had a question about former President Trump's recent third indictment, this time on charges related to the January 6th insurrection and election obstruction. Some of those responses may be shared on a future show. You can join that group by sending the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. And you can find more information about that, as well as every other way to contact us, on our website, 21stshow.org. And while you're there, you can find links to our podcasts, or just look us up on Apple or Spotify by searching for The 21st Show. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Kennedy Vincent, and Jose Zepeda. Our intern is Nick Boyvin. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.